Hey, how's it going, yous? This is Eric Longauger. Welcome to Beijing Diary. You guys are in for a real treat today. I'm talking with a friend of mine who's an anthropologist, and he's got a lot to say about his travels around the world and some of the things he's seen, and then also a little bit about his personal beliefs and philosophy. So let's go ahead and listen in, and then we'll come back at the end and have some more thoughts to share. Okay. So you're from North Carolina, right?
I'm from Georgia originally.
Oh, Georgia.
Yeah, grew up in Atlanta.
Oh, okay. Oh, I see. And then you went to college in North Carolina.
I went to University of North Carolina, in the 60s.
But then your major, was your undergraduate major anthropology also?
My undergraduate major was a little confused. I started to study geology, and then I found that what I really liked about geology was camping on the surface of the earth and the way the mountains look, and I really didn't care that much about the physics of rocks 3 miles down where the oil is, you know, that kind of thing.
Oh, okay.
I got bored of the science. And I was for about a semester, I was a geography, human geography major, and then I finally did 2 years, and my degree was kind of vague, international studies, but with a concentration in Asia.
Oh, okay.
Which is how I got interested in China, because I had a wonderful course in modern Chinese history by a time professor.
But that was in the 60s?
That was 1966, I believe.
Wow. So your course in modern Chinese history, you were taking right at the time that the Cultural Revolution was beginning.
Yeah, and nobody really knew what was going on. It sounded interesting to those of us who were opposed to the war in Vietnam, for example, which were quite a few of us.
Yeah.
And we didn't know what was going on in China. I was not that attracted to the Cultural Revolution, but nobody knew. You know,
it was
this crazy thing happening, and we didn't know.
Oh.
But it was interesting to... Well, we went back, and the course was from 1911 to 1949.
Oh, okay.
So it's the background of, you know, modern China. I was just fascinated by the scale of history that I had.
So that's sort of the Ming Guo period then.
Yeah.
Wow.
Warlords.
That would be interesting.
That is
interesting history. It's fascinating history because I studied too just on my own, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, after 1949, the Kuomintang went to Taiwan and...
Yeah.
Up until that time, you would have thought maybe that Chiang Kai-shek, you know, Chiang Kai-shek, really was not as strong a leader. But if you, but after 1949, when he went to Taiwan, he was able to control the country, you know.
Well, he had a pretty large, experienced army, and a relatively small land area and population to control.
Yeah.
And they had just been liberated from Japanese colonialism. And in the beginning, they were happy to see Chiang Kai-shek arrive.
Well,
and then a couple of years later, they rose up and the Chiang Kai-shek's army killed about 20,000 people.
Yeah, that was bloody.
1947.
They weren't happy to see him. They fought against him.
The
local people in Taiwan.
Well, yeah, but not in the beginning.
Oh, really?
In 45, they were liberated from Japan, and they were going back to... The way it was put, it's being given back to China.
Oh, okay.
And that was... They didn't quite know what it would be, but they welcomed the idea. But by 47, Chiang Kai-shek's army and police and everything else had made themselves so unpopular.
Yeah.
That there was a rising. And
oh,
it was put down
okay.
Very brutally.
Very brutally, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's important to know for people that, you know, get confused about the politics today, you know.
Yeah. It's
and I mean both Americans and people from China.
Yes.
Who don't really grasp that
right.
That reality. Because the Taiwanese natives are not anti-communist, they're anti-mainland. You know?
Right.
But then after college, you didn't come toward China, though. You went to the
other. I didn't quite know what I wanted to do. I joined the Peace Corps, then I dropped out after 6 weeks of training. And I spent a year. The reasons for all of this are not particularly relevant, I don't think. But I dropped out of training and went back to my college town. I had a job in the library for a year and saved some money and thought, well, I'm not going in the Peace Corps, but I'm going overseas. So I bought a passenger ticket on a freighter and sailed from Montreal to Swansea in Wales. And then I hitchhiked.
Montreal, Canada?
Yeah. Oh. It's where the ship left from. I can't remember what it was, but it's a ridiculous price these days. Yeah. It was $150 or something to Britain.
Oh, so you first went to Wales.
I first went to Wales. I hitchhiked to London, and I went around Britain, and I hitchhiked through most of Europe. And went through East Germany and Czechoslovakia briefly at a time when Czechoslovakia was interesting before the Red Army stopped the Prague Spring of socialism.
It was 68, yes. But the Prague Spring was 68.
Yeah. And I went on, and I wound up in North Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And found that an interesting idea and decided I wasn't ready to go back to the United States, so I wound up teaching English in the Kingdom of Libya. This was the year before Colonel Gaddafi took power, and they were hiring teachers because they had oil money all of a sudden and a very uneducated population.
Wow.
I was a lousy English teacher at that time.
But you liked the Libyan people, though.
Yeah, I was fascinated by the desert. Took a long trip in the Sahara when the roads were not good, thank you. Like, large parts of it weren't paved.
Did you have a Jeep?
We got a old Land Rover, which had apparently arrived in Libya with the British because it had a steering wheel on the other side of the car. And that was back in, I think, 53 or 1, you know. I mean, and we drove it way... Myself and a couple of French friends who were teaching French there.
Yeah, but you weren't driving it in 1951.
I was 6 years old in 1951.
Yeah.
No, but we bought the car in 1968.
Oh, yeah.
But it was that old.
Oh, okay.
Not in terribly good shape, but we didn't die in the desert, so served it.
That's interesting. I think my dad bought a car, and I think it was in 51, bought a Chevrolet Curio.
Uh-huh.
Over across the United States and shipped it over to Japan.
Uh-huh.
So that's what they did in those days, you know.
Yeah.
They brought their cars with them.
Yeah.
Now you wouldn't go to, now if you're moving to Japan, you wouldn't bring a car with you.
No, I don't think so.
But how did you end up in Afghanistan?
Well, after my year teaching in Libya, I traveled a little bit more. I went to Istanbul, through Greece, and then back across Europe and went back to the United States. I went back to my university town, spent a year, most of a year, involved with some left-wing students and ex-students who were largely organized in opposition to the war in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, well, I'm making this kind of long, but anyway.
No, that's all right. No problem.
After that, what the our group kind of split apart, as many groups did in 1970 or so. And I thought, well, what am I going to do next? And I thought, well, I want to go to graduate school, but I don't know Chinese, and I want to study Chinese history and politics. So I tried to study Chinese for 3 weeks. A friend of mine was teaching at the university, and I sat in the courses and looked at those characters for 3 weeks, and I knew myself, and I thought, I'm never going to do this. So I bought a plane ticket to Taiwan, spent 3 years there teaching.
Oh.
Studying Chinese, but teaching was...
So you started learning Chinese in the States and then picked it up in Taiwan.
I didn't get anywhere with it in the States. That's why I went to Taiwan. Where I did get it, you know, it was a matter of real people speaking real
language. You were actually in Taiwan before you went to Afghanistan.
Yeah, I went after Taiwan. After 3 years in Taiwan, I learned a good bit of Chinese, but I had no money. And I wound up with a teaching position in Laos, Fulbright Teacher Exchange. And I was in Vientiane for a year and saved some money. And then I had some friends who were young journalists, freelance journalists in Laos. And I thought, you guys are doing more interesting than what I do. And they looked at me and they said, look, the war is winding down. There's a lot of people in Southeast Asia that know a lot more about what's going on than you do. And the stories are becoming fewer and fewer because now it's 1974.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to do that, go someplace else, but don't bother to try to do that here. So I thought, well, different part of the world, something different. What about Afghanistan?
Go to Afghanistan.
So I went to Afghanistan. I arrived in February in the snow by bus in 1975.
By bus from where?
Portugal, Paris, across Europe, Istanbul, train to Tehran, and then a bus from Tehran to Kabul.
Oh, okay. So you flew from Laos to Europe?
Well, I had a free flight home from the job.
And
I took it as far as New York and then bought a ticket to Portugal. My parents went on vacation there, and they hadn't seen me for quite a few years. Then I went to Paris to look up a friend, and then after Paris, I moved east again.
So how long were you in Afghanistan?
From beginning of February, 75, to about the beginning of September, 76, and then I was there again the summer of 77. During that period, I managed to make myself useful to Western archaeologists who were working in Afghanistan, and I did a lot of gopher work. I wasn't a trained archaeologist, but I could drive the Land Rover. I learned to speak the language. We had students out there who...
You learned Dari?
Yeah. Well, Dari, yeah. Not really well, but I could go anywhere and speak.
Did you speak Pashto too, or...?
No, never learned Pashto.
Yeah, that's very interesting, because,
that was Afghanistan. I loved the place at the time.
They call it the Graveyard of Empires, and there's just been so much conflict for so long.
Oh, it's so sad, because the long history of Afghanistan involves invasions by Mongols, Iranians, British, Russians, everybody.
Yeah.
The Afghans are the tough people who managed to stay there between these empires and even create their own for a while.
Yeah.
And... yeah, it was a non-centralized sort of society, and there were feuds between this group and that group sometime. And people were tough, and they know how to use guns. But then they got the Soviet Union, and the one thing that they have always been good about is resisting invaders.
Mm-hmm.
And the invaders this time had steel airplanes. Tanks.
Yeah.
And these guys were warriors, but they weren't disciplined soldiers. Mujahideen.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then they got support from some not very pleasant American policy and from some pretty nasty, some of them were. But that's what happened in the 80s. And I greatly admire the resistance, but I don't admire what was done, how they were manipulated.
Well, I read Peter Thompson's book on wars of Afghanistan, and Hillary talks about the conflict between the CIA and the State Department. They were really at odds with each other.
There was that, yes.
And so the CIA was working, I think, pretty close with Afghanistan, with Pakistan. And Pakistan's sort of an enigma. You know, supposed to be an American ally. But also allied.
Also supposed to be a Chinese ally. Yeah.
Yeah, but also allied with the Taliban. You know,
that the force, the power in Pakistan for decades, internal. What is? Everybody knows the name of this.
The ISI.
This means
the intelligence?
Yeah, yeah. they've had a great deal of autonomy for a great long time.
It's the Pakistani version of the CIA, basically.
Yeah, except that they're much closer to sympathy with people like the Taliban.
Yes, definitely.
And that, you know, it's a very confused place. It's a beautiful country. I spent some time there. The north of it is...
In Pakistan?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, I met a lady in when I was in, you know, during the years I lived in Beijing, I always went to, or very often went to Western China during the summertime.
Yeah.
And I met a lady up on a Tibetan plateau who had just come from Pakistan, and she said, I'm having a hard time getting used to, you know, walking down the street and not having someone invite me in for tea. You know, she said the local people are very friendly.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, it's a place that's divided up many ways, and it's a you know, politically it's had a lot of obvious problems, and then there are these wars with India over Kashmir, which, as far as I'm concerned, shouldn't ever have happened, but the British left India in a peculiar way. Things did not work.
Yeah, they should have. The British should have, in my opinion, they should have settled the Kashmir issue before they left.
Well, the way they settled it was, not good.
But of course, actually, Pakistan used to be Pakistan. And India is all one country then.
Yeah. All one. Yeah.
Oh, I mean, all one colony,
British
or whatever.
Colony, yeah.
So I think that's part of the problem that never. That thing never got resolved before.
No, and then they split. You know, Pakistan involved what today is Bangladesh.
Yeah.
And it was essentially ruled by West Pakistan.
I remember that.
The Bengalis didn't like it.
That was what was that, in the 60s when they split up?
71, 72.
Oh, 71, 72, okay.
Yeah.
I remember 72. when that took place. And, but Pakistani and Bangladesh, you know, the ones I've met in China, both very friendly.
Yeah.
Yes. But there's, you know, so you look at Pakistan, you say, okay, that's an ally of the United States, but in fact, not necessarily. It's just so confused.
Yes.
You know?
That's,
And so, you know, I mean, Osama bin Laden was hiding out there from like a couple miles from ISI headquarters.
When Zia-ul Haq ran it at the point when they were the closest as allies to the United States, it was run by a man named Zia-ul Haq, who was a right-wing dictatorial, I don't know quite what you... he was not a Taliban type, okay? No. But he was a... I guess you'd say he was a strict Muslim, and there were not democratic rights, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's... That was... He was running the country, you know, in the 80s when it was sort of close to the United States. Backing... I think the U.S. has backed a lot of bad horses.
Well, yeah, and he was telling Bush, because that was Bush Senior at that time, don't worry, we'll never have nuclear weapons, and they were developing right. Well, at the same time, he was saying that, you know.
As were plenty of people.
But you know, it's gut wrenching history, you know, to see what happened in Afghanistan. And so last August, when they were moving out of there, and everybody's saying, "Oh, I guess we better get out of there," but you know. Almost as if that's the appropriate thing to do, but it didn't have to be that way.
No, I don't.
You know, the Americans had a legitimate casus belli to go into Afghanistan because of the 9/11. You know.
Well, actually, I think that could have been handled differently too.
But they didn't have a legitimate casus belli in Iraq.
Well, that's certainly true.
So, what if they had just stayed in Afghanistan and focused on building that country? You know, and helping that country to become stabilized, don't you think it would have been a lot different?
I don't think that, I don't think the U.S. should have gone into Afghanistan the way it did.
Really?
Right. I think the situation of Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden should have and might perhaps quite likely could have been handled with international negotiations.
Did you have to turn over Osama bin Laden, or?
Yeah, as a criminal.
Yeah.
Rather than invading the whole country.
Well, yeah.
And A led to B, and B led to C, and look at us now.
Yeah, if they could have done it without that, because
wouldn't have been easy. But I,
in fact, they ended up assassinating Osama bin Laden, which I don't like really either.
No, I don't believe it. The way it happened either.
He should have been tried.
Yeah.
In a court of law.
Well, by that time, everybody thought, you know, oh, there's this huge problem. It's Osama bin Laden. Well, yes, but movements like what he was involved in were not limited to some one guy.
No, that's true.
And getting rid of him did not solve any problems. Well, you've got long-term historical
but I, you know,
economic and political.
So it just really troubled me last summer when that whole thing came down. You know, they Bagram Air Force Base, they turned off the lights and walked out, you know.
Yeah,
they gave the whole place up.
Pretty much.
And at the time I was communicating on WeChat with an Afghan guy that I met in Beijing.
Hmm.
And I just met him briefly in Beijing one time and got his WeChat. And so from time to time, I would communicate back and forth with him.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he was in London for a while. And then, so when I when this stuff started to happen in Afghanistan, I sent him a message in WeChat. Mm-hmm. I found his contact in WeChat. And he was in Afghanistan at the time. He was in Kabul. And he said his brother had worked in the government of, in the previous government, you know.
Who was the... Was that Ashraf Ghani government?
Yeah, I think that's Ashraf Ghani.
Yeah, I knew
the guy who took off, you know.
I knew Ashraf Ghani when I was in Afghanistan in the '70s.
Really?
He was a postgraduate student in political science in the U.S. Very bright guy, very entertaining. He came over for I had dinner. You know, he was this young, bright Afghan guy who was obviously interested in politics, you know, and from a family where you could do something with your interest in politics. His family was, you know, they weren't poor.
Yeah.
And he was well educated, like I say, he was studying in the U.S.
So, yeah, so you had a pretty good impression of him then.
Yeah, but I won't say I had a deep one. I mean, I met him, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 times, you know,
yeah.
Or maybe even more than that, I don't remember. But at the time he was, you know, he wasn't, you know, the great man that you had to stay away from. He was this 24-year-old, 25-year-old
yeah.
guy that you could talk to about all sorts of things, and he was a very interesting man to talk to.
Right. Well, now he's not viewed very positively because he took off, you know, right before the takeover.
I know.
They tried to get, you know, Zelensky to do that in Ukraine, and Zelensky stayed, and so, you know, he's viewed much more positively.
I don't know very much about him.
But, you know, the thing is that these guys, this guy, he responded to me in WeChat, and he said his brother had been involved in the government, and
right.
so they were worried.
Right.
And I tried to contact him a few days later, and I
couldn't get
to him. Yeah. So I hope they're okay, but I haven't heard a thing from them, and no contact at all.
Yeah, well, I lost track of, I had some Afghan friends who, the 70s, who... Oh, there's one good friend of mine who's a Pashtun. He was, he didn't have much education. He could write his own language, but not well.
Mm-hmm.
And he couldn't speak. He picked up a little English.
Yeah.
He'd been a bodyguard for the Crown Prince before I arrived in Afghanistan. He's kind of a rockhead guy, but solid, you know.
Yeah.
Somebody you could count on, sort of thing. And I have no idea what happened to him.
Yeah.
And I never will. I mean, because he, you know, the idea of using a... I'm sure he's probably still doesn't have a cell phone. If he's still alive. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. It's Well, you know, the thing that really got me interested in Afghanistan was sort of my last... sabbatical in 2011, I left my. I was teaching at the software college at Beihang University, and informed me that they had an age limit, upper age limit of 55. That's not a national.
55.
Yeah, that's not a national thing. That's a university thing.
Right.
So I just took a sabbatical, moved out to a village, and I was looking at different things, and I remember I was watching, you know, something on YouTube or something, and I saw these little kids in the West Bank. And a bunch of little kids, and not in West Bank, it was in Gaza.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. And Gaza, you know,
yeah, I know
it's that. Kind of a turmoil place. But, you know, the United Nations in there. And I talked to an international journalist in Beijing one time. She said Gaza's like a rabbit cage, you know.
Yeah.
It's not a real good situation. But
no.
I'd see all these little kids with their United Nations, you know, backpacks. And
yeah.
Then you see Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And the kids are playing in the streets.
Yeah.
No school. I mean, the contrast is just stark, you know.
Yeah.
And I thought, man, there's got to be a way to do something about that, you know.
Well, yeah. And it's got a lot to do with, I don't know. It's got a lot to do with global forces. There are rich countries, there are poor countries. And there are economic interests which are not going to help out the disadvantaged if they can't get something out of it for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes on and on and on.
Another thing that's kind of interesting about Afghanistan is, you know, when you study the Old Testament, after Solomon, under Solomon's son, Rehoboam, the kingdom was divided.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually the northern kingdom was taken by the Assyrians.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question is, you know, where are
Where's
the 10 tribes?
Go?
And the Mormons actually believe that the American Indians are the 10 tribes of the Lost Tribes.
I have heard this. I don't know.
But there's a study at Hebrew University, I've heard, that is doing a DNA study to see if the Pashtun people are actually the 10 tribes of Israel.
The Pashtun people have a legend. This was told to me. They have various legends about their ancestry.
Yeah.
Right? And it was, they were not things that were nailed down by any historical research that I knew about.
Mm-hmm.
But they were stories that had persisted, and one of them is that, oh yeah, we're related to Jews. And these people, you know, this bad image that Afghanistan has gained thanks to people like the Taliban, you know, had so little to do with Muslim belief when I was there. Your
mm-hmm.
average guy was very much a Muslim. He believed in God, you know, and he didn't. There was very little drinking. Nobody ate pork. But, there were areas where people would say, well, you know, five prayers a day, I don't know, nice idea, but I don't think so, you know. It was not a fanatic sort of society. And the music, which the Taliban banned. I can remember sitting in tea houses and hearing guys, this is literally true, I heard a man sing a song for well over an hour in Pashto, and I had some friends with me were basically telling me what the song was about. This hour-long song was being sung by an illiterate Pashtun man in a tea house in Afghanistan. And the story has been taken from Iranian high literature,
mm-hmm.
which was the story of Yusuf and Zuleika, Joseph and Zuleika. I don't think,
mm-hmm.
I'm not sure, but I think the name Zuleika doesn't appear in the Bible, but it does appear in Islamic works. But anyway, it's the story of Joseph in Egypt.
Really?
Okay. And the song is about... The whole song was about, you know, two or three lines in this story. 2,500 years after this event. Here is this guy in Afghanistan. And it was playing this, you know, it was good music. You know, lots of rhythm and wailing voice, you know, in a language that, you know, you had Hebrew or Aramaic, or I'm not sure about the language that Moses spoke or that Joseph spoke, but from that language, then the Bible, then you had Arabic, then you had, Islam and Iranian language, and then into Pashtun, and then sung by this guy in a tea house where I was sitting.
So that ballad he was singing was
75.
It was probably really old.
Well, the story was.
It
was probably, you know, improved, changed, whatever, over the years, exaggerated, mispardoned, diminished. But obviously the guy had added a lot of words to the story, because in the Bible there's not that much.
But, I mean, it sounds like he didn't actually get the story from the Bible. He got it from his culture.
Yeah, oral culture.
Yeah,
the country was 90% illiterate when I was.
Oral tradition handed down rather than something that missionaries brought them.
Over 2,500 years.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of talk about that, you know, if the Pashtun people are originally the 10 tribes.
There are Pashtuns who have told me that. You know, I think we're supposed to be related to the Jews. Yeah, we're related.
They celebrate the Yom
Kippur. We're the wandering tribe that walked away, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
So you where'd you go after Afghanistan? Because you were also in you said you'd been to the city of Petra before.
Yeah. Well, after Afghanistan, I got interested in I put it this way: I'd done a certain amount of traveling. I liked Afghanistan. I traveled a lot in Afghanistan to some difficult places to get to.
Yeah.
I began to feel that I was seeing a lot more than I could understand.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a girlfriend who was British who was working on a PhD there in anthropology. And she said, well, why don't you study anthropology? And I'd thought about this before. So I got myself accepted at four universities in the School of Oriental and African Studies in London. I didn't get any three American universities, but I couldn't get American education was beginning to be a lot more expensive by the late 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And British education was cheaper, and it's very good. And I wound up in London for 2 years studying as a MPhil, a notch above an MA.
Yeah.
And a British-oriented degree. At the School of Oriental and African Studies. Studied very hard and then dropped out without getting the degree. And I moved to Paris and I was there 3 years. And then the Soviet Union, Red Army went into Afghanistan and by 1983 I got myself back to Peshawar in Pakistan, yeah. Somewhere in the middle there I was in Kuwait. Yeah, I had to go to Kuwait to make some money. I didn't have any money. So I taught English there for a year. And from there I went to a dig in Jordan.
Oh, okay.
With archaeological friends I'd known in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
And we visited Petra, among other places.
Wow.
Yeah. Beautiful place.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, it's talked about in prophecy. The evangelicals talk about it prophetically as being sort of a hiding place in the future. So it's kind of interesting, you know, how if you look at the physical geography of it, it really is a fortress.
And it's got its own history, but I don't know that much about it. You probably know more about it than I do, but I've got, well, one of my archaeological friends, I checked up some facts, and I'm writing a fictional story, and I have a character who's kind of a mysterious character, and he's originally a Nabataean.
Oh, okay.
And so I'm writing fiction, mind you.
Yeah, you told me you're writing a novel.
Yeah, well, I dug into some of the stuff that my archaeological friend had written. He'd written numerous books about Middle Eastern archaeology and learned enough about Nabataea and Petra to use for my fiction. I went into it just so deep. I didn't. But I did become aware of the long history, not particularly well documented, but there's a story there that perhaps hadn't completely been told yet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting. So, when did you start writing your novel?
2014.
Okay.
I kind of rolled into it based on anecdotes and diary stuff that I'd kept over the years. And a friend of mine who'd had a major operation, an old friend of mine, and I was going to write about our relationship kind of for his wife, who I knew her husband before she met him.
Yeah.
So I was going to write about the old days. Then I thought, well, this doesn't fit. This has to fit into a larger context. And the context got larger, and now I'm talking about cosmology, the end of time, quantum physics, and all sorts of things that I don't have any background in. And there's still a Nabataean wandering around spaceship at the end of the universe.
So you've been working on it for, what, 6 years now?
Yeah, I kind of finished it in 2019, and I perhaps made the mistake of showing drafts of it to friends of mine, and I didn't get too many comments, and I thought, I know what that means. Now, they don't like it, but we're friends, so they're not going to tell me. And I looked back at it, and I thought, yeah, this is pretty bad, so I started fixing it. And that is actually, now, it is, with a couple of changes I might think of, and they would probably be matters of a few sentences. That one's finished, and I'm 370 pages into another one.
Oh.
Which is related to the first one.
Well, now you can do a Kindle. You know, you can publish your own book.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
So you might want to think about that. Yeah. They stick with the, they just put it on Amazon, and, you know, somebody orders it. It's called Publish on Demand.
Yeah, I got a friend here who's done that. Mm-hmm. He wrote a book while he was here. An American guy. He's here every year until the coronavirus kept him out.
Yeah.
He was here every year for a couple, two months, 3 months. Couldn't speak a word of Chinese after all that time. Book wasn't too bad, considering that the guy...
How long was he in China?
He first came to Kunming. He adopted a Chinese orphan about 2000.
Oh, okay.
And then he and his wife, I may have the order of this wrong,
mm-hmm.
but anyway, he and his wife lived here for about a year. His wife apparently didn't like it that much. Anyway, they moved back to the States, but he'd been coming back every year, 2 months in the spring, 2 months in the fall, from, I don't know, 2003 when I met him, until 2020 when the coronavirus hit. And he's now online, you know.
Yeah. So you said you're working on a dig in Jordan, and then and somehow you ended up in Asia. How did you make that transition? Because you actually got your PhD in Hong Kong, right?
Well, that came later.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I dropped out of the program at the University of London. I spent 3 years in Paris. I taught for a year in Kuwait. I was on the dig in Jordan. And then I went... see, where did I get on the plane? By land as far as Amman and Damascus, and flew from there to Pakistan to see what was going on in 1983 in Peshawar on the Afghan frontier.
Oh, okay.
And I was in and around there for about 3 months, and then I was in India for a total of about 8 months, where I spent much of the time having hepatitis and not doing anything. But I was in Varanasi, Benares, mm-hmm. Shiva's holy city, right? It's the weirdest place in the world. The way I put it is that if you go to India and you come back with answers, you don't know anything about India. You come back with a whole lot of new questions you never thought about before. Then you maybe learn something.
Oh, okay. So how long were you in India?
I was in then. Well, I was in Pakistan for 3 months. I traveled in India for 3 months. I was back in Pakistan for 3 months. And I moved essentially to Benares the end of August 1984. And I was in Benares for 6 months. First couple of months, I got over the worst part of the hepatitis, but you're affected by it for months later. So
yeah.
I'd go out and I'd walk around, and then I wouldn't feel so good, you know.
Yeah.
So it was a little slow that way. I was going to study
hepatitis
Hindi.
B or hepatitis?
Huh?
Hepatitis B.
A.
A.
Well,
okay.
Okay. It was kind of finally analyzed later by a Western doctor in Kathmandu, and he said, yeah, well, you had hepatitis, and the reason I'd gone to see him is that I was apparently over it. but I wanted to know.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, yeah, you're over it. He said, you're... And I said, really? And he said, yes. He said, and he kind of looked at me and he said, look, it's just like you never had it. Your liver is fine.
Mm.
And I thought, well, that's good because I like to drink beer. And I said, well, what was it? And he said, non A, non B.
Really?
And I said, what does that mean? And he said, look, he said, we Western doctors categorize these foods. You know, there's A, there's B, there's C. And then we come to South Asia. And then we learned that these categories are, you know, kind of wishful thinking. So I can't really tell you, but you're fine.
Well,
I was, and I have been ever since.
Yeah, my mother had hepatitis A, actually, when I was born.
She did?
Yeah.
Did it affect you at all?
Well, as far as I know, not after I got, you know, to where I developed, you know, I was too much premature. Heavily jaundiced, I guess, and
yeah.
My mother told me I was so weak I couldn't even cry. I just squeaked, you know.
And?
But I mean, I, as far as
you seem to have gotten over.
Other than that, it doesn't seem to have any bad effect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You don't get much sympathy in India if you tell people that you've got hepatitis. You want a little sympathy, and Indians, middle class Indians, all kinds of Indians say, "Oh yeah, my sister had it. Yeah, 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 yeah. You'll be okay. Just don't drink, don't eat oils, eat simple foods, and don't drink. You'll die." And wait 6 months, you'll be all right.
Yeah. Well, that's...
all right.
That's hepatitis A, though, right?
It's hepatitis A.
Yeah.
A lot of Indians...
Well, like you say, it's a different variety.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess it's A. You know,
yeah. I got the...
something like A.
I got the inoculation before I came to China for hepatitis B.
That's probably wise. I haven't. I've been, I don't know, not getting things.
I should probably check it again and see. But
yeah, I could do.
So anyway, what we were talking about is how you ended up from the Middle East into Asia.
Oh, yeah, it did get complicated. Oh, wow. Well, all right. I was in India extending visas, and finally I couldn't, and I wanted to study Hindi at Banaras Hindu University.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a tourist visa, and they wouldn't sign me up. Said, you have to get a student visa. And I said, well, how do you do that? He said, well, you can only apply from outside of India.
Oh.
I said, all right. And they said I should go back to my country, the United States, to do it. And I thought, well, that's a long way and a lot of money. So I went to Bangladesh and applied from there. And I was 2.5 months in Dhaka trying to get a student visa, go back to India, and finally couldn't do it. So I got on a plane and flew to Kathmandu and spent a year there.
Oh.
This is getting very complicated. I traveled through India from Pakistan.
You mean you traveled through India afterwards even though you couldn't get a student visa?
I got a tourist visa, passed through India to to Pakistan again, and went into China for the first time in 1986 in June.
You went to China from Pakistan?
Yeah, over the road.
Wow.
15,000 meter pass.
15,000 meter pass. You went through that long, narrow strip?
No, that's from Afghanistan.
Oh, okay.
Pakistan has its own.
Oh, place. Yeah, yeah. Oh,
and you come down to Kashgar you've been through Kashgar. The Pamirs, which are the most fantastic mountains in the world. I hate this thing.
Yeah. I haven't been up to there, but I've been to Kashgar.
Yeah. Interesting. That was my kind of introduction to China. I came down out of the mountains.
Your first introduction to China was Kashgar.
First city I came to, yeah.
Wow. That is fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah, the, Kashgar, I was there for 2.5 weeks.
Uh-huh.
And in 2005 I went out there.
Uh-huh.
That's a fascinating place, you know.
I thought, I agreed. I like most of the rest of Xinjiang. I came overland through Xinjiang to Beijing. I spent all about 2.5 months in China at that time, came out through Hong Kong. Then I did get a visa to go back to India. Went and met some friends. I'm trying to get to the Far East. Anyway, I went back from India because my father had a heart attack, and I spent 3.5 years within striking distance of home. He was doing okay, but he wasn't getting older.
Yeah.
And I finally decided that I was living in Washington and I wasn't immediately necessary for my parents who were in Florida. And I thought, well, you know, I can get to Florida from Hong Kong. It just would take 24 hours longer.
Yeah.
So I moved to Hong Kong. And I wound up doing my PhD at the University of Hong Kong.
Okay.
Years later, with a fellowship.
Yeah, so that's...
They like my background.
Yeah. Wow. So then after you finished your PhD, that's when you came to China then. No, you were in Taiwan for a while, right?
Well, I was in Taiwan in the early 70s.
Oh.
The PhD involved research among the Ami people. Amis, actually. Pangta, you can also say. Of Taiwan. Mm-hmm. And so I spent 2 years... I was based in Hong Kong from 1990 to 1996, but two of those years altogether were actually spent in Taipei doing my field work for my anthropology PhD, and then I was living with Taiwan Aborigines in a working class suburb of Taipei.
Oh, okay.
So I was back to Taiwan again for that, you see.
Now, you did some research in the United States, too, though, right? Because you told me you were at Wheaton College.
Oh, that was a... No, that was a two-week visit.
Oh, okay.
Or a one-week visit. I don't remember. I wanted to dig up
material. Billy Graham... what do they call that? The Billy Graham's...
Yeah, the archives that Billy Graham actually set up. And that came later, because after I'd come to Kunming, I got interested in the history of Yunnan. And especially interested in the history of foreigners, however you want to define them, in Yunnan province. And I started looking at things, and among others, that involved quite a few missionaries.
Hmm.
And that was where, you know, they had the missionary stuff. So I, on a trip back to the United States, I went to Wheaton and spent every minute I could in the archives, photocopying things just as fast as I could.
A lot of stuff there, huh?
A lot of stuff, yeah. A lot of stuff. A lot of interesting stuff, yeah.
Did you charge anything for it? Or just...
No. Very pleasant, very nice, very cool, you know. I was from the outside. They didn't know who I was, but I was interested in... Yeah, fine. Yeah.
So after you finished your PhD, then, is when you came to Kunming?
No. After I finished my PhD, I could have had a position, I'm sure. Nobody in the field would doubt this, in the field of anthropology concerning Taiwan. I could have had a position at the Academia Sinica in Taipei. Not much money, but they give you an office, and they don't ever take it away. It's a state institution. But at that point, my parents' situation was not so good, and I'm an only child, so I flew back and spent 3.5 years in Jacksonville, Florida, trying to keep my parents moving.
Mm-hmm.
And my father died in 2000. My mother was in pretty good situation in a rather nice retirement home, and healthy. And I went back to Hong Kong and spent 2 years there teaching a couple of courses at the university. And then I came to mainland China, first in Yanyang, Sichuan.
Oh.
And I was based there for a year and a half.
Really? I was in Yanyang in 2008 when the earthquake, you know.
Oh, yeah. You were there then?
Yeah. I got a hold of a family church, a house church in Beijing.
Uh-huh.
And They had some guys going out there, and I flew out there with them, flew to Chengdu with them, and then there was a house church from Qingdao that was doing a ministry up in Beichuan. Beichuan is a little place.
Oh, where, yeah, yeah, where the
school
center
was
of the earthquake. Yeah. Well, more or less.
The center was actually Wenchuan, but the...
That's right.
But Beichuan was where that school was that collapsed, you know.
Yeah.
It was like a foot and a half off the ground.
Yeah, yeah, I saw pictures.
The whole thing was buried in the basement. And believe it or not, I met a couple of high school girls who had been in that school. I said, where were you when the earthquake was? They said, we were in that school. I said, you got out of that school alive? Where were you? They said, we were on the third floor. I said, how did you get out of there? They said, we jumped out the window.
Uh-huh.
I said, you jumped from the third floor? They said...
Good tactic.
They said, by that time, the third floor became the second floor and the first floor.
Yeah.
It's just terrible, you know. But they got out hardly without a scratch.
Well, they were very lucky people.
But all the kids on the first floor, of course, were buried in the basement. 900 students.
I know. I remember how horrible it was at the time. I don't remember the details, but I remember the scale of the details.
But I think it was in Mianyang that we stopped by. We just checking to see. You know, we taught at a government school that they set up for the kids in the summertime, and I. Mm-hmm. And we went into one place and just asked if we could talk to the kids. There was a whole bunch of kids in this big room.
Yeah.
And so I asked the teacher. There was a group of students there from Chengdu University,
uh-huh.
just volunteering for the summer. And so I went up to the teacher, one of these students, volunteer students. I said, can you translate for me?
Uh-huh.
And she said, yes, I can.
Uh-huh.
So I went to each student in that classroom,
uh-huh.
went right to their desk. And I said, what do you want to be when you grow up?
Uh-huh.
You know, what's your dream?
Uh-huh.
You know, monks are so, you know.
Uh-huh.
What is your dream? And, you know, then she would interpret for me. And then, it'd say like, I want to be a scientist.
Uh-huh.
I want to be an astronaut.
Uh-huh.
And all these big dreams, because I want to give them something to think about positively, you know.
Sure.
Because their whole life has been devastated.
Yeah.
And so I visited one of the 10 camps where they lived. It was just pretty tough. But I got toward the end of this group of kids, and there was a little girl about 10 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked her, what's your dream?
Yeah.
And she looks at that teacher who was translating for me, and she said, I want to go to Chengdu University and study English so I can understand what he's saying. I said, you know what? That is the smartest kid in this room. She's found a practical reason to get an education.
Well,
you know, you can imagine this 10-year-old kid, you know, sitting there.
Yeah, everybody wants to go to the moon.
Rural Sichuan.
Yeah.
And this student comes in from, a university student, volunteering to help the kids in the summertime.
Yeah.
And she thinks her university student volunteer teacher is just an average Chinese young person.
Yeah, yeah.
Then this foreigner comes in there, and her teacher understands what he's saying.
Yeah.
She just was blown away by it.
Life experience.
Just completely blown away by the fact that, you know, her teacher was magic. She could understand this foreigner.
Yeah.
And she just, I want to do that.
Yeah.
So there's a very smart little girl. And she's, I don't know what she's doing today, but I think on the pathway to success. So that's interesting. You're in Sichuan for a while. And then you came to Yunnan?
Yeah. Sichuan had to do with a project that my Hong Kong girlfriend thought up. Which was a little complicated. She used to think up complicated projects, but she was very hardworking and convinced me that we should go to this place, Mianyang, which had made quite a bit of money from making televisions.
Mm-hmm.
And they also had a military research going on around there, which we were not supposed to bother with much or talk about. Anyway, the thing was that the city was pretty well off, and they had a reasonable middle class, and the head of the Culture Bureau decided, well, now what we got to do, you know, we got, economically we're okay, now we got to do is improve the local culture,
mm-hmm.
which would involve all kinds of things. Well, my girlfriend thought, okay, my girlfriend also had connections with both university and the Hong Kong movie industry.
Mm-hmm.
And her idea was to make a film about some people in the mountains in a valley not too far from Mianyang, who called themselves the Baima Zhangzu, which means the White Horse Tibetans.
Mm-hmm.
And me, as an anthropologist, I was going to go up there and do a study of these people because they claimed that they'd been miscategorized, that they weren't Tibetans.
No.
Their language was different. They didn't like milk products.
Mm-hmm.
Their housing styles were different. Anyway, in the end, things kind of fell through. And I got kind of bored in Mianyang. It was a pleasant enough city, but I didn't particularly like it. And in the middle of this, we visited Kunming once. And I stayed around for a month in the summer of 2002, it was. And I came to Kunming, and Kunming's a much more relaxed town. I like the altitude. The weather's good. The climate's good. There was no air pollution. I met a poet. I met some anthropological filmmakers. I met a German guy who was teaching anthropological film at Yundai.
Mm-hmm.
And just liked the place. And when I decided I didn't want to live in Mianyang anymore, I just packed up and moved down here.
So what year was that?
2003.
Oh, really? Okay.
When I moved here, November.
My first time trip to Kunming was in 2001.
Oh.
But I was just here for a couple of weeks. We did a benefit project up in the north part of Yunnan province with a church in Arizona.
Okay.
But then I went back.
What, out of curiosity, what part of the northern part of Yunnan province?
It's called Shigu.
Shigu.
It's now become a rock climbing resort area.
Oh, yeah.
But at that time, it was just a little village. It's on a first bend of the Yangtze River.
Is it a Han village or is it a minority village, or do you know?
I think primarily Han, but I'm not sure, actually.
Okay.
But, yeah, it was a nice little village, but now it's become, I never could have imagined it's become actually quite well known, because it's a rock climbing resort.
Mm-hmm. We got rock climbers here, you know, foreign rock climbers. Yeah. Colin Flahi, one of the owners of Salvador's.
Yeah.
Big rock climber.
But I bet he probably goes up to Shigu.
I'm sure he does. I don't know.
Shigu is the rock, a stone.
Oh, Shigu.
Gu is the drum, right? Stone drum.
Well, Gu, yeah, I think it's probably that character. Yeah.
Anyway, so, stone yeah, that's where I was. We just did there was a little elementary school that had an old Buddhist, met in an old Buddhist temple. Their school was in an old Buddhist temple.
Mm-hmm.
And they, we gave them some computers and set up a network for them and taught them how to use, you know, they'd never seen computers in their lives.
Yeah.
But then I went back to the States and eventually got a job in Beihang University teaching software. So I ended up in Beijing for 16 years.
But, yeah. 16 years?
Yeah. I was in Beijing for 16 years.
Yeah.
And then I left because of COVID, you know.
Yeah.
As I said, the cops.
Right.
Well, I think it's partly COVID and partly because my landlady told me that Xi Jinping actually ordered the building of that huge museum or something for the party. You know, it's a monstrosity, and I guess it's something, a museum for Communist Party history or something.
Okay.
And that back end of that is right across the street from where I live. You know, it's right next to my place.
Yeah.
So they might have been a little nervous. You know, somebody saying.
Yeah.
You know there's a foreigner living in that place?
Yeah.
What's he doing there?
Yeah.
You know, the police actually came to my apartment because they discovered that I was not teaching anymore.
Uh-huh.
Living in China on a tourist visa.
Right.
And I didn't know when I moved to that village back in 2010. You know, I thought the leaders of China lived in Zhongnanhai, you know, in the city of Beijing.
Yeah.
But in fact, they don't. That's their office.
Right.
They used to. Mao Zedong lived there.
Yeah.
But now, the modern leaders, they have their own little enclave out in the Western Hills, which I don't blame them. That's where I live. You know, it's a nice part of Beijing.
It is.
And then they have their own private subway that goes into town.
Oh, I didn't know they had their private subway.
So, actually, they're my neighbors, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know the exact name of the place, but it's not far from where I lived.
Right.
And if I had known that, I would have been second thoughts about moving out there. But
well, I've been living in a... I guess you would classify it as a lower middle class, upper working class, Xiaoqiu, which is the second so-called modern Xiaoqiu built in Kunming, or the first. Anyway, it was built in 92 or 93 or something. And it's kind of old style.
Yeah.
But they fixed it up nice, and I've been there for 19 and a half years in two different apartments. And I'm the only foreigner in the area. And nobody knows me well. We're all good.
Yeah.
And the police, you know, oh, you're that old foreigner that's been here forever, you know.
Well,
like, come on in, have some tea.
Kunming's a little bit more laid back about foreigners hanging out, you know.
Yeah.
They seem to be, you know. The mountains are high and the emperor's far away.
There's that. And there's also the fact that I think people in Yunnan are used to the idea that not everybody belongs to the same ethnic group, because there's 25 ethnic groups here.
That's true. That's true.
And they had the French back in the day, and they had the Americans saving the world in the Second World War. You know, so
Flying Tigers.
Flying Tigers.
We're situated based here.
Right. Running off.
This
the
is
Japanese
the terminus
bombs.
Of the old Burma Road.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they had troops here. Yeah. Kunming had.
This is where the Burma Road started or ended, depending on the direction you were coming.
Yeah.
And I've read two accounts by somebody who drove the Burma Road.
Uh-huh.
One guy was a missionary I met when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
A guy by the name of Elliot Lundahl. And he was talking about, you know, driving the Burma Road with a truckload of Bibles. And then later I read his book, and he describes it, you know. And then I read another book by a guy who was sort of affiliated with the Communist Revolution or whatever. And, but he was a lawyer in Hong Kong, and he drove the Burma Road. But it was a way to get, because they're flying over the hump, you know,
it was kind of dangerous.
They lost a lot of people.
Yeah, they certainly did. Yeah, well, in my mother's retirement community, I met a guy. My mother was, I know, I'm 70. Well, all right, this was early 2000s, so I was about 60.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother, I'd go visit her in the retirement community, and she was a lot older than most people in the retirement community and in a lot better physical condition because she danced ballet all her life as a ballet teacher. And she said, oh, I see these old people every day, but I just don't pay attention. They're all playing mahjong or something. I just go out and have lunch with my friends. Anyway, she wanted me to, you know, sort of, she was, I guess, sort of flattered by the fact that I'd show up every year from the other side of the world for a birthday and would, you know, introduce me to a few people. There were a number of, especially naval, but also other military retirees in this fairly nice retirement community. And she introduced me to this one guy. He'd been on the Burma Road, too. And he allowed me to copy some stuff from his diary, which he happened to have. No, his wife had it. He died.
Mm-hmm.
That's how it went. The thing is, I looked at the diary. His job was driving donkeys over the road.
Wow.
But he did get the Kunming. So I put him in my notes. You know, here's another guy. This guy.
He had a diary about driving donkeys over the Burma Road?
There was something about donkeys. I could look it up. I got thousands of pages of stuff in there somewhere. You know, this guy you just mentioned, his name, Undahl?
Elliot Undahl.
I'd be interested at a later point maybe to see what...
Yeah, I'll try to get the... I know it's on Amazon, the book.
He wrote
two books, but I can't remember which one was talking about the Burma Road. But he's a very, very talkative, good storyteller.
Okay.
And he, you know, my parents were missionaries in Japan. And so I met him once when I was a kid.
Uh-huh.
He stopped to visit my parents.
Oh.
And then later I read the book
and
recalled the stories he was telling.
You wouldn't remember the title of the book, would you?
One of the book was called One Crowded Hour, and the other book was called In Those Days or something like that.
I guess I missed those.
But he was a missionary, and he also worked. I think he worked for the Taiwan government, you know, Kuomintang government. Because he was born and raised in China.
Yeah. Oh.
He was born and raised in China. But he later ended up in Taiwan. You know, the missionaries in 1949 were kicked out.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's just a fascinating storyteller. And he drove, you know, there's only two accounts I've read by people who actually drove the Burma Road.
Okay.
You can read about the Burma Road in history, but finding a personal account of someone who's actually been across it, not that easy. But that...
I might be able to help you out. I'm not sure what I got when I have
that. That was Kunming, you know, that was the terminus.
Yeah.
Kunming was the terminus.
No, I'm very well aware of that.
Yeah.
You know Jesse Miller?
Oh, I'm not sure.
Well, I think he lives in the Xiaochu behind Slice.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's there a good bit, but not a whole lot, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He's been in China, he's been in Kunming for at least 10 years, and he's done some adventurous stuff with various people, but I met his father before I met him, totally by accident, at Salvador's one day, and I just got talking to this guy I'd never seen before, His father had been a doctor in the Second World War in the U.S. Army in Kunming. And he took some of the earliest color photos of... And this isn't exactly right, because there was a Frenchman, André François, I think was his name, back in the early part of the 20th century, that took... anyway, the point is Jesse Millet's uncle, not his father, was this guy I met, by accident. And he has a website with lots of photos of Kunming in 1944, 1945, that are unique in some way. I thought it was the first color photos, but I'm not sure that's true. But anyway, a lot of interesting photos.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting to me that you traveled around a lot of places. Well, once you got to Kunming, you didn't travel anymore. You just pretty much...
I didn't plan to stay for 19 and a half years when I got here. I just kind of liked the atmosphere, you know.
Well,
it was about at that time that I thought, okay, I can do anthropology. I've been up in, I've done my PhD work in Taiwan. Enjoyed it, learned a lot from it. Very glad I did it. And, I was up this valley in Sichuan, and I realized I could do it, but I also realized that after all, my Chinese is not perfect. This does involve a fair number of historical records, which I'd have to dig out of somewhere, written in Chinese, and I can read it, but it's work.
Yeah.
And I got to Kunming, and I thought, well, why not? There's this gang of foreigners here in Kunming, you know. And I thought, well, this is something that relates back to my own life, in the sense that in the 60s, a lot of people went off hitchhiking to India looking for wisdom or whatever it was, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Young people, mostly. Well, here I am in Kunming, and there are these people who showed up on bicycles and took their backpacks off, and they're still here. And I thought, well, that's an interesting scene, you know. And then the more I got into that, the more I think, well, yes, but this didn't all happen in one moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I read John Israel's book. Did I tell you about John Israel's book?
I don't think so.
History of Xinan, Yunnan, Xinan Lehe Dashi.
Oh.
1937 to 1946, where some of China's best scholars and students, running away from the Japanese, who were busy invading, you know, eastern China, and there was this university here.
Oh, so that was located right here in... Korea.
That was located right here, and John wrote this big two-volume study. He was one of the first foreign scholars to come to Kunming after the, you know, early 1950s. He arrived in 1980 when there were four other foreigners in town, with the exception of maybe an East German, you know, technical advisor or something. And he got me really interested, and I thought, well, yeah, there's this whole background, flying tigers, I didn't know anything about that. I remember Terry and the Pirates, you know. And so I started to read about that, and then I thought, well, yeah, and then there were these missionaries that were here, and then there were these early doctors, and then there were the French, and then I connected things up with, you know, I spent a year in Laos, Southeast Asia, the French Empire in Laos, and the railroad, and I kept going back and back and back, you know, in my mind, and I pretty much got back to 1762, and I thought, that's far enough, John. We're not going back to Marco Polo, and somebody else has written it anyway. So I started collecting stuff. You know, there were Catholic priests here at the end of the 18th century who were quite, some of them were quite amazing people, I think. They were individuals on their own, not in groups, with a certain lack of sympathy from the imperial government in Beijing. Wandering around trying to make converts and doing everything else, learned Chinese, and they were here for the rest of their lives, and they knew it. That was the way the Sciences étrangères de Paris, the Foreign Missionary Society of Paris. That's the way they did things.
Yeah.
You went out forever.
Yeah.
And they, you know, their stories are great, you know.
Yeah.
And there were quite a few of them. And then there were the explorers. Anyway, that's...
Have you been to the Flying Tigers Museum?
Yeah, sure.
That's interesting, you know, because they... The United States, this is before 1941, you know, this is before December 7th, 1941.
I know,
so,
I'm aware of the dates.
So they're not allowed to, you know, if they start attacking the Japanese, they could be arrested as war criminals, right? There's no...
Theoretically.
No declaration of war.
Right.
So they signed up as... They were commissioned into the Chinese Air Force.
Well, they were, but they were paid by the Americans.
Yeah, paid by the Americans.
Kind of under the table is what it amounted to.
Paid by the Americans, but commissioned into the Chinese Air Force.
Yeah, with a theoretical private organization. Yeah. Franklin Roosevelt being clever, really.
Quite interesting.
Yeah.
So, you know, something about Kunming stuck you, and it's like after that, no more traveling. So, but you've been around Southeast Asia, of course.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was kind of curious.
I guess it's partly age. Partly age, but also partly just liking Kunming and getting into this thing about, boy, there's all this history and stuff that I don't even know about. And I began, you know, writing things down and reading things and going places in Yunnan province. In fact, if people ask me where I live, for many years I'd say Yunnan.
Yeah.
Then I would say China.
Yeah.
It got to be Yunnan
province. Well, there are 55 official minorities in China.
Yeah.
And I think like 25 or 26 of them are located in Yunnan province.
Right,
So it's an ethnically diverse...
Yeah. And they flow, and the ethnicities flow across borders into Burma, Laos...
Oh, that's true, yeah.
Thailand, Vietnam as well.
Because
there's a pre-nationalist sense
because
of things.
Because the Dai people are actually Thai, right?
They are a... The higher category is Dai.
Mm-hmm.
And beneath them, we have the Thai of today, we have the Lu.
Oh, okay.
They are all Dai peoples, and yes,
okay.
Their languages and cultures are certainly related.
Yeah.
Because
they have the Dai, I know the Dai people have that water festival.
Sure.
Which is very common in Thailand.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Now, Kunming is not really the biggest expat community in China, though. Probably in Southeast Asia. It's probably one of the smallest.
In China?
No, I mean in Asia, you know, Southeast Asia or whatever.
Probably
the largest would be Bangkok, huh? As far as where expats go to hang out.
I would say that's probably right.
Because they have that big Bumrungrad Hospital and, you know, it's...
And,
of course, Thailand gives retirement visas to Americans.
Right? Yeah.
But it's interesting that you know, as I say, I lived in Beijing, but in the summertime, Beijing is just insufferable.
I know, I've been there.
So I always came to the Western Mountains, and I noticed that when I met people in the Western Mountains of China, both Americans and British, to a person, they would all say, forget Bangkok, go to Chiang Mai, you know. So
I guess so.
It's almost universally, people tend to prefer Chiang Mai, right?
Well,
it wouldn't be universally because Bangkok has more foreigners than Taiwan.
Sure.
Chiang Mai, but.
But I know, I can think of two guys right now, both of whom happen to be Americans who, one of them used to live in here, and now he lives in Chiang Mai. Then there's Lester, who's on his way.
Yeah.
And then there's another guy who was based in Chiang Mai, but he came up to Kunming a lot, and I got to know him when he came up here, and he's been in Chiang Mai now for, I don't know, 35 years maybe.
Yeah. Well, Chiang Mai is just easier to get visa. The visa situation is easier.
Well, I guess it is.
And the other thing is that, well, definitely, because you can get a retirement visa there, right?
Yeah, but you said Chiang Mai.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think Chiang Mai is any easier than Bangkok.
No, but much easier than here.
Oh, yeah.
But as far as the visa situation.
Oh, yeah.
The other thing is that China might be a little bit awkward if you don't speak Mandarin, whereas you don't really need to in Thailand.
That's true, and in a way it's a little bit unfortunate. Kunming, we all agreed on this, and I think Jeff Crosby would say it's still true today. I'm not so sure, but he may well be right. In the early 2000s, it seemed very clear to me that more of the Westerners who were in Kunming spoke reasonably good to more than just reasonably good Chinese, that percentage-wise, than the various Westerners I've run into in any other city in China. Mm-hmm. I think Jeff would say that's still the case. Maybe, I don't know.
Well,
which is something that I think is important if you're going to live in a place for years and years. And the thing that gets me about Chiang Mai is that it's so easy to get by in English that I know a lot of people down there. They've been there for decades and they don't speak more than a few words of Thai to order groceries.
Yeah, but it's very different because
it's very different.
China is a police state. And so
it tends to be.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, you just have a different. In China, you need to notify the police within 24 hours, and that's the law.
Yeah.
And so China, what a lot of people think, police state. Oh no, you know. But in fact, if you speak Mandarin and you jump through the hoops and you keep track of what the hoops are. It's not that bad.
No, it's not. But recently it's been confused. But
the cops don't speak English, you know. So,
no, of course not.
So living an independent life in China, the language is much more important than it would be in Thailand.
I agree.
And I knew a guy. I didn't know him personally, but his girlfriend actually ended up at the church there. As mentioned earlier, you know, he came to China. He got this 10-year visa. Oh, I can stay in China for 10 years.
Yeah.
And it says right on there in English, duration of stay 60 days. He just totally blew that off.
Yeah.
3 months later, he got arrested, and he was incarcerated for a year, and they shipped him back to the States.
He was incarcerated for a year?
Yes.
Holy cow.
I mean, you know.
I thought they'd just throw you out and say, you'll never come back.
No, they keep you there until they got enough to fill a plane load.
Okay.
So, I mean, you know, what I'm saying is you can't just blow it off. This is a police state. But the thing is that, as you know, you live in here for all these years. If you keep track of what you have to do and you jump through the hoops, the cops, you know, most of the time are not too bad. As I said, I did have that run in my village in Beijing with the
I've had the same experience.
And even then, I didn't get upset.
Right.
I just told my landlady, you know, why didn't they tell me?
Yeah.
Just tell me. We don't want you here. I'll be gone tomorrow. You know.
Well, Kunming, I think you've probably noticed that Kunming's a bit easier than that.
Yeah.
So the word police, actually, Taiwan in the early 70s, when I was there for 3 years studying English, studying Chinese, was way more of a police state than China is today.
Taiwan?
Oh, yes.
Really?
Chiang Kai-shek was a dictator.
Well, that's true.
A party dictatorship.
That's true. That's it was not really democracy.
No, it wasn't close. They had 41 years of martial law.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. But and the Gongnamju here is much better than the entry and exit office here.
Uh-huh.
They have been much more helpful to me than Beijing was.
Yeah, you told me. Yeah.
So I've not had a problem really with the
No, I haven't either.
But if you don't speak Mandarin, you know, the people that come here, like you've been here for a long time, but people come in their 60s or and they don't speak Mandarin, they're just a little more frustrated. Whereas Thailand, you could fly there, you know.
Well, it's their economy too.
Never having been to Asia, and you'd probably.
As you know, the reason. One of the reasons Thailand is opening up now is that the loss of tourism for 2 years is pretty serious in Thailand.
Yeah.
Much more so than in China.
Yeah, because they live so much on tourism, and they were so popular as a tourist.
Yeah, especially a town like Chiang Mai. Yeah. Small town, not that big a population, but a lot of tourists.
Yeah.
And retiree people as well.
Because of their retirement visa.
For both.
And the medical tourism.
And that. Yeah.
So one thing that I talk with people a lot about, you know, when I was a kid, I was 13 years old, my parents took me to America.
Mm.
And
surprise.
That was culture shock. Yeah. I had been there. I went to first grade in America. But you know, I reacted to it, you know. I wanted to visit America, see my cousins and so on, but I didn't want to stay there.
Yeah.
But, you know, the reality of life was I had to stay there. And so I finally sort of resigned myself to it. It took a long time. But I thought, my parents left their country to go to another place. I should be willing to leave my home in Japan. And And so I became a student of culture. You know, when I left, when I got out of high school, mm-hmm. instead of going to university, I went out on the highway and stuck my thumb out and hitchhiked across the country. And one thing that in my process, the process of trying to understand culture, I came to the belief that if you want to understand a group of people, two big questions you have to be able to answer. The first question is, what do the people believe?
And how do they believe, which is a little different.
And the second question is, why do they believe it?
Okay.
So
yeah, all right.
So I thought the first question is easy. Hmm. Just ask them. The second question is more difficult because people don't always know why they believe what they believe. And maybe not even be honest with themselves about why they believe what they believe.
Right, and it's also perhaps questionable as to how much they believe what they believe.
So when I came to China, I found out even the first question is difficult because I'd ask people, what do you believe?
Yeah.
And they would say, we have no belief, you know.
Yeah.
We Chinese have no belief.
People will say that.
Woman Jungle has a male submachine gun. And I was talking to a guy just the other day. He says, we're talking about different beliefs. He says, don't believe any of it.
Yeah, yeah. No, I know the attitude you mean. You see it everywhere.
So, what do you believe?
What do I believe?
Are you atheist, agnostic, whatever?
Well, that could get really get to be a really complicated discussion because I think we get to the point where the concepts that the words we use represent concepts, and the concepts are not the same as the reality.
Mm-hmm.
I think you would agree with me. If you said, I believe in God,
mm-hmm.
okay, I understand the words, but surely this is not like, I believe that these cigarettes were produced in, you know, China. It's about an experience, I would imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And experiences are not the same thing as concepts.
Well, but doesn't it depend on whether you believe that there is...
Well, there's a relationship.
There is such a thing as a personal God, because if there is a personal God, you... Now, I've often said I'm handicapped in dealing with this issue. I mean...
I think we all are.
And what I mean by that is, I don't know what it's like. You know, I grew up as a Christian.
Yeah.
I grew up from a Christian background. I don't know what it's like to go out and look at the stars and say, it just happened, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know how it would feel to be an atheist.
When I go out and look at the stars, and when I went out and looked at the stars when I was a kid, I was amazed by the stars.
But didn't you ask how they got there?
Yeah, I wondered, you know, how's the universe, what's everything? You know, I mean, kids wonder about everything.
Yeah.
I didn't have a dead answer that I said, I know how this happened. But I did go out and read astronomy books when I was, 9 or 10 years old.
Yeah.
So
what conclusion did you come to? I mean, do you still see yourself as searching, or have you arrived at a basic belief system?
This is going to be a little vague, which is why we kind of came at least to a working understanding about the term spiritual reality. And I'm
yeah.
not sure either one of us are exactly on the other guy's wavelength here, but mm-hmm. it's something we can work with, you know.
Yeah, I can't remember when I first said that, but it's somehow that we kind of lost.
It was
into
it was a passing comment, but yeah. I thought that's. I think I can talk to Eric on that basis. You know? Anyhow, no, I would say something like this. I think you can create this model, a scientific model, evolution. Quantum mechanics, which is pretty hard to get your head around, cause and effect, sheerly on a materialistic basis.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is a working conceptual tool that helps us get around in life.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, we build automobiles. Might not have been a good idea now that we're ruining the atmosphere. But okay. But it's like, you know, it was like what Kierkegaard's objection to Hegel was. Hegel had this idea where this kind of wacky but thorough and very fascinating attempt that he made to sort of reconstruct the mindset of the ultimate mind, which is sometimes, he sometimes calls it God, but he more often uses the word mind,
mm-hmm.
which kind of tells you something, because it seems to me that if it's only a matter of mind, then that, you know, it's a, you could have a computer or something.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, where have I gotten to now? This is, okay, so we've got this conceptual tool, and let's say, you know, scientific, atheistic, if you like, model mm-hmm. of the reality that's around us. And it's very effective. It's very useful. However, I happen to be alive, and the important stuff for me is, yes, I like to know, you know, how my motorcycle engine works, and I like to know something about how my body works because I get sick sometimes, you know. And all of this is very useful, and you can learn a lot. Science is a very practical tool for dealing with these things.
Mm-hmm.
But when we talk about existence, you know, Kierkegaard's objection to Hegel was, for the sake of argument, I will accept that Hegel's solved all everything.
Mm-hmm.
And Hegel, mind you, was not being a scientist. He was a believer in this God who is ultimate mind, sort of.
Mm-hmm.
And Kierkegaard said, yeah, the only thing he left out was me.
Mm.
Existentialists. And so, you know, here I am in the world. And after I know how all the tools work, conceptual, mental, intellectual, or whatever, there's still this other thing. Karl Marx, for example, built a lot on the way that Hegel thought things out. But Marx made this criticism. Hegel is dealing with concepts,
mm-hmm.
but the relationship of the of man, as what Marx would have said, you know, the human mm-hmm. being, to reality is not a conceptual one, but a sensual one. Mm-hmm. It involves emotion, perception, not the ideas of emotion and perception, but the actuality of it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That means something to me. You know, I can think about the world. I've done a lot of study. I got a lot of ideas about anthropology in my head. But, you know, and I know something about Taiwan Aborigines. But when I'm with my Taiwan Aboriginal friends, the reality that I'm trying to participate in, I'm not quite there, you know. I'm not an Aboriginal. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can pick up on certain things, and I know what a handshake makes, and I can trust this guy and this guy here I'm not too sure about, you know. But this is not about a matter of material model toolkit,
mm-hmm.
you know. It's got to do with a communal human relations.
Yeah.
Okay. And that involves, let's call it, I think we live in a spiritual reality. Now, what you asked me was what I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I kind of wandered away from that. But the reason is that, well, okay, question. God. Let's say the statement, the atheist, God does not exist.
Mm-hmm.
Or the believer, God exists. This exists.
All right, let's figure it out later.
This exists. Maybe God exists, but what the hell are we talking about when we say exist and we're talking about a being behind the three letters G-O-D?
Well,
what does exist?
Well, I think
existentialism. You see what I mean?
Yeah, but I think it's really the same in a way. You know, like, for example, you hold up the cigarette lighter and say, "I know this exists."
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a material object.
Well, that's true.
Sensual. I can feel it.
Yeah.
I can burn my fingers with it.
That's true. It's easier to determine that it exists, I suppose. But you know, there are non-material things that we can maybe not feel in touch, but or something, but we get like love or
right
emotion, you know, that we believe in for some reason.
Well, so, I would say that believe in is one way to say it. I would say we experience it. And to not see that is to be a blind intellectual.
Well, let me just tell you what where I'm coming from.
Sure.
The way the Bible, the Bible's position is, I was talking to a young guy, this is many years ago, I was working in Oregon State Hospital, and he had come from sort of a Christian background, but he became an atheist, I guess, or atheist or agnostic. And he said, believing in God requires an extra assumption. You know, extra assumption, because you have to assume something you can't see, and for which there's no... And Bertrand Russell made a similar comment. Someone asked him, what are you going to do if you die and you find out you're standing before God, you know?
Yeah.
What's your excuse going to be for not believing in him?
Yeah.
And Bertrand Russell said, I'm not worried about that because there is no God. And they said, yeah, but just if you were, what would you say? And he said, I would say you didn't give me enough evidence. So the biblical position is
all
that
right.
The evidence is overwhelming.
Yeah.
So in the book of Romans, it says there are two things you can know about God without the benefit of a Bible or anything, just from nature.
Okay, what?
It says eternal power and his divine nature.
Well, you said his.
Yeah.
Well, eternal power, why not the eternal power of the atom? I mean, I'm not...
But the atom didn't put the stars in the sky.
Well, who put God in the position of creating the universe? I mean, this can go on forever.
Yes, but you see, God is God, you see. So God is, by definition, uncreated.
Yes. And what that means to me, I think it probably, to me, it means something like the reality that I live in, you know, experientially as well as, you know, intellectually and various other ways. That is the uncreated. I guess that's what I would, try to say it. And here I would recommend reading up on Buddhism, because some of their thoughts pretty
that's
good.
That's interesting that you mentioned Buddhism, because when I was teaching at the China Youth University, some students came to me and they said, we want to talk to you about religion. I said, okay, then we went to the coffee bar and they said, no, Buddhism, Christianity, they're all the same, right? And I said, well, there are basically two parts to religion.
Yeah.
The first part is how we should live, what we should do, shouldn't do. The second part is the fact that we don't do what we're supposed to do. So what do you do about that? And so if you talk about how we're supposed to live, Buddhist, Christian, Buddhists believe you shouldn't murder. Christians believe you shouldn't murder.
Right.
You know, you shouldn't commit
adultery. A lot of people say that and go off and do it.
Yeah, exactly.
As we know.
So the belief about the way we should live is quite similar.
Yes, but Bertrand Russell was a pretty good moralist as a humanist. I mean, I don't have a lot of
the belief system
criticism
about how we should live is very similar.
Yeah.
Now, I believe that comes because not because of familiar with the Bible, because the Buddhist never seen the Bible. It comes from, you know, as the Book of Romans says, the law of God is written on our hearts. So there's a sense of what's right and wrong that's embedded in every human being. But the question is, the problem is we don't actually do that.
Right.
So now what do you do?
Right.
Then that's where religions differ vastly. Because the Buddhist says, you know, you die, then you have another birth, and then another death, and birth, and death, birth, death, So the Buddhist always has in their mind that, okay, if I don't get it right this
not
life, I'll try to do better next time, you know.
Yeah.
Whereas the Christian Bible says it's appointed unto man once to die, and after that judgment.
Yeah.
So there is no next time.
Okay.
That's two very different concepts, right?
That is, yes.
I remember when my dad told me when he first went to Japan, and he was a young missionary, and he didn't know anything about Buddhism, and there was a tuberculosis hospital. There was a lot of tuberculosis then.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a tuberculosis hospital had a death ward.
Yeah.
And he said, I'm going to go in there and talk to those people.
Right.
He said, no, you can't go in there. Those people are dying. They're hopeless.
Right.
There's nothing you can do for them.
Right.
But he said, no, I want to go in there. So
right.
he went in there, and actually he did contract tuberculosis, but he was able to, you know, recover from it.
Okay.
But he talked to a guy laying flat on his back.
Yeah.
He's about 30 years old, tuberculosis, he's dying.
Yeah.
And so my father, as a Christian missionary, said, "Would you like to live forever?"
Uh-huh.
And this young man said, "No."
Really?
Because his concept of live forever was
the eternal cycle of birth and death, which is all awful.
Going on forever and ever and ever.
Oh my God, I'm going
to no end.
Yeah, let me out of that. I want to get off this train.
Yeah, he wanted to get off this train.
I understand. Yeah.
So there's a completely different concept,
yeah, it's
right?
Very, yeah.
And you have to understand that when you're trying to communicate,
yeah,
different ideas, you know.
Yeah. Yes. No, I agree with you. There are many common areas that we can find on which to agree.
Yeah.
Almost regardless of what we believe in, unless it's, you know, I should kill everybody. You know, I'm a psychopath or something.
Yeah.
When you go deep enough, I don't know, I think... Well? Well, yes, certainly. I mean, you can't... Christianity is not a religion that accepts the concept of reincarnation, unless there's some weird Christian somewhere that do. I mean,
no. Yeah, I know. That is a contrast.
That's certainly a contrast. But see, that brings in the whole concept of what is time anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a ongoing friendly disagreement with a friend of mine who's. Background is basically Trotskyism, mm-hmm. You know, the opponent of Stalin,
mm-hmm.
As the party developed. He was, he wouldn't have been perfect either, but he probably would have been a better guy. But anyway, my friend is quite well read in all of this, and we have these arguments, and I come up with these statements about, you know, reality is actually now.
Mm-hmm.
And he's, you know, Marxism is a historical way of understanding. You know, it's very complex.
Well,
Marxist thought is quite complex.
Is your belief that reality is now based on Taoism?
Well, no, it's more based on... I don't know how I accept this as the case... But I think it, Jean-Paul Sartre, the existentialist who was very popular in France, mm-hmm. especially after the war, so, wrote some very perceptive works, I think, and some very interesting fiction. Anyway, his thing was like, you know, you wake up in the morning and here you are.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, here you are, dumped into existence with no, it's absurd.
Yeah.
There is no, it's just here you are. Then you can start thinking about it if you like.
Mm-hmm.
But no matter how much you think or how much you do, it starts with this moment right here. This is the place and time from which everything else stretches away. The past is no longer present. The future is only a bunch of ideas. The restaurant down the street is not present here. Okay?
No, we're sitting here, you know, and...
So what is time and space, you know? And this is what quantum physics...
The reality that we're experiencing right now will not be less real tomorrow. It'll be in our past, but it will not be less real.
It'll be different. It won't be the one you're experiencing. It'll be the one you're remembering.
That's true.
Different. Significantly different.
Well, different, but not less real.
Living in the past and living in the present are very different things.
Oh, okay, I understand what you're saying there.
Yeah.
If you're living in the past and not able to deal with the present...
Or vice versa.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Living in the present and not able to deal with the past?
Yes, in the sense that history is, you know, gets rewritten from different points of view, mm-hmm. all through history, and Marx talks about that.
Yeah.
You know, which is why the party line keeps changing. That's a very bad example. I'm not a big fan of the party line. But well, that's a corruption of this writer who I respect named Karl Marx. You know, the party's line keeps changing. There's a, you know, the Soviet, old Soviet joke. The past keeps changing, but the future is absolutely sure. We're always leading to, you know, the end of the rainbow.
Yeah.
Which, it'd be a nice goal, but if you start believing it's reality, then you've got a different problem. Then you've got a problem.
Well, the problem is we live in a mortal, you know, we're immortal beings, but living in, with a mortal reality. We're not going to live forever on this life.
You're assuming a reality of time, which I'm trying to get my head around.
Because one of these days our life is going to be over. You know, you're going to live to be 80, 90, 100.
Sometime in the future.
And so,
where I'm not.
Then, you know, after we die, where are we going to be?
Yeah. No, I get the question. But then the question behind that is this thing about there is nothing like the present.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing like the present. Not for you, not for me. You know, right here, right now, cheers.
I agree with you, but you could also say there's nothing like the past or nothing like the future.
Yeah, you could, but where are you living?
I just want to know, I just want to be sure that when I get to the future, the present is as real and pleasant and livable as the present now. And so, you know.
Well, this is why I'm worrying about my visa next month. Whether or not I'm going to have one.
Right.
But this is planning for the future. And one difference between I won't mention the name, but one of my business associates whom you know, who has white hair. And, every time I talk to him, it's always like he's nervous, very, very nervous about the visa and this and what did the lawyers say and what are we going to do and why didn't you say that, John, and why didn't you do that? What exactly did the man say? You know, he's really worried.
That's understandable, though. That's understandable.
It's understandable. And I understand it, and that's why I'm not going there. Monday will come and something will happen, and I'm doing what I can to take care of it.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to go around biting my fingernails all the time.
Well, that's the thing, doing what I can to take care of it. So
yeah.
We do what I can to take care of what we can to take care of Risa.
Yeah.
But do we also do what we can to take care of where we're going to be after we die?
Good argument. Good point. I could say I don't know how to do that. Okay. But with a little luck, I can take care of the present. And the Buddhists are good at that. You know, the meditation and all of that, it's not bullshit.
Yeah.
You know, you can disagree with points of it, but there's a lot to be said about being able to keep your eyes open and know what you're doing in the moment.
See, if there is
it's
a
not
God,
bad.
If there is a God, and we are rightly related to him, then our existence in the present or after we die, we don't have to worry about either one.
I got it.
Because he's over and above all those things.
Okay, yes.
But we all recognize that we don't measure up to God's standard. We can't.
As we believe it is.
Yeah. So it seems to me that, you know, I was talking to, I've asked a lot of Chinese young people, what are you going to do when you die? You know, ask them what their belief. And it's interesting in China, people don't talk about that. But they never get upset if you ask them. They're very open.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll usually say something like, I have no belief or whatever. And I was talking to one young lady and I said, what's your plan after you die? And she said, no plan.
Uh-huh.
I said, no plan?
Right.
You go on vacation for 2 weeks, you plan every second or every minute. And you have no plan? And she said, well, actually, we Chinese, you know, we don't believe there's anything after this life.
Right.
So we don't need to plan.
Right.
And I said, well, then why do you burn money in the streets?
Yes. I was just going to bring that up in my town, too.
Yeah.
Every year, especially at the Ghost Festival.
Yeah. Now, that's in the summer, right?
Yeah, it's usually August.
Yeah, I see that. That matches sort of the Obon in Japan. But in Beijing, I see it at Chinese New Year. And so I said to this lady, why do you burn money in the streets? She said, what? I said, you burn money in the streets, you know, for your dead relatives. And And she said, that's just, we don't take that seriously.
Yeah, that's true.
We just do that because we want them to have a good time wherever they are. I said, wherever they are?
Mm-hmm.
Wherever they are?
Yeah.
You just told me there's nothing. Yeah. So all of us have to deal with that.
Yeah.
So, you know, in the I guess I could say, you know, why I am a Christian, because all of us have a choice, basically. We can stand before God and be judged by the kind of life we lived.
Mm-hmm.
Or we can be stand before God clothed in the righteousness of Christ and be judged by the kind of life Christ lived.
Yes.
So for me, it's a no-brainer, right?
Yes, but you're assuming I'm going to have to corrupt some words here because none of our words quite fit.
Yeah.
As far as I'm concerned, maybe Joan Baez said it well once. Joan Baez, the singer.
Mm-hmm.
Familiar with it, right?
Oh yeah.
Four words. Somebody asked her about. I don't know what it was. You know. Her answer was, my religion is living.
Really?
Now, I think a Christian could say that. The living God, maybe.
Right.
But that isn't the way she meant it. She meant, you know, right now. And I think if I were to define spiritual reality, I would say that's this thing that we're living in.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to call it God, you can. But that assumes a consciousness that is other than ours, and it seems to me consciousness is something that we share. And you can ask where it has come from, and I'm putting words in your mouth, but it would seem that that might be the next question. And I guess I'd have to say, I don't know, but we got it.
Well, I guess I would say if that consciousness or that being or that entity is something other than God, then whatever that is.
But what would be other than God? If spiritual reality is the reality that we live in, what else is there? Materialist models of the universe?
What I'm saying
they're
is
useful too.
Again, getting back to looking at the stars in the sky, they didn't just happen, you know. I mean, I couldn't do that. Could you?
No, I couldn't. But, you probably know, I mean, we all know enough astronomy, to know theories of, the Big Boom, at the beginning of everything, the Big Bang, and the stars spread out, and then people argue about why they're where they are and where it's all going, and that kind, you know, there's that kind of explanation.
Yeah.
Which is I would say it sounds like a good model.
You know, I was really fascinated by Stephen Hawking.
The stars are the
You know, Stephen Hawking, toward the end of his life, he talked like he was almost kind of flirting with the idea of Christianity.
Yeah.
And then at the very end, he says, he concluded that because of the law of gravity, the universe could have created itself. But then who created the law of gravity, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Every body is attracted to every other by a force which is directly proportional to the product of their masses and inversely proportional to the square of the distance between them.
That's Newton,
That's Newton. So that's pretty fantastic, right? I mean,
how does it work? Why does it work that way?
And how did it come about? You know, so.
Well, I think we thought it up to explain this reality that we're living in.
And who created that reality?
We created. No, the what I'm trying to say, and not saying it will.
No, actually, you're communicating your ideas.
Is well. That this thing that we're in is what there is, and the other things are reference points.
Yeah.
That's about as far as I've got.
Well, you got a lot of interesting ideas. Oh. It's really, really fascinating. Talking with you. That's been good, John.
Yeah, I've enjoyed this too.
Any other thoughts to add? Things to add before you?
The what?
Final thoughts? What advice would you give to young people?
I would say,
Well, I can think of a way to say it that wouldn't, that nobody would like, but I won't say it that way.
Go ahead.
Well, the way I'd, there's a quote that I think is not exactly accurate, but it's close to the idea. Something that Sartre said is that we are condemned to freedom, which makes it all sound very grim.
Yeah.
I think that we're stuck at it with it in a sense, and that for whatever reason, you are responsible with what you do with it. You are not assured of anything. And the only real question is, what do I do next?
Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, leads to the idea of a political consciousness, an understanding of the world as best as we can, and seeing injustice, brutality, unfairness, lies, hypocrisy, and that we are involved in all of this, and that if you don't do anything about it, you are being carried along with the tide.
Yeah.
And being carried along with the tide, when we look around the universe these days and we see not the stars, but, well, yes, we can still see the stars, thank God, but we also have global warming. We have the stuff that a distinctly and uniquely materialist competitive lifestyle has produced all of this wonderful progress. Good example, medicine. Unfortunately, the same forces that gave us modern medicine have also given us machine guns. They've given us exploitation. They've given us international war. They have given us nuclear weapons. And now they're destroying the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so does progress with a capital P mean anything? Well, you're involved in it, and so am I.
Yeah.
And we better get it straight, because I'm not sure there are going to be any second chances.
Yeah.
And ask the species that have already been eliminated, the forests that have been cut down, and the fish that are poisoned. All of that. Largely a product of greed. I can go on and on, but, institutionalized within, I'll call it capitalism, but that's a wide term, really, as is socialism.
So if greed is the fundamental problem...
Greed is a big problem.
Then it's really a question of the human heart, right?
Yeah, and who was it that said or wrote that the real sin or the worst thing is to treat a human being as an object. And Wall Street is all about manipulating objects represented by numbers that are controlled and are the global system.
Yeah.
And the revolutionaries who go against it are failing. Probably not a good way to solve things. But,
Yeah, I think...
Trotsky said... Excuse me, you got me on one of my favorite subjects again. Trotsky said, and I'm not advocating anything here, and I don't think he was either. Revolution is impossible until it becomes inevitable. Let's not do it that way. Take responsibility now. Because if we don't, we'll either be destroyed by capitalism or destroyed by some bloody revolution that fails and leads to Stalin.
Well, this is a concern that I have in looking at America, because in China you have the, dynasties, one dynasty after another, and you can study the pattern, how a dynasty rises, how a dynasty falls, and you see the consistent, what is a falling dynasty look like, dynasty in decline look like, and what does a rising dynasty look like.
Yeah.
But in America, there's only been one dynasty.
Essentially, yeah.
And so the Americans have no concept of this.
No, it's always progress. So, everything's getting better day by day. And we're on top of the world.
And so they have no concept of being aware of what a civilization in decline looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, America looks more and more like a civilization in decline.
I think a lot of people would agree with you from very many different points of view.
And so, but Americans seem to be completely unaware of that.
Well, right. We don't have a, you know, I think even, well, even, I think Europeans have a better concept. I mean, you look at French history, you know, mm-hmm. strong times, weak times. British Empire no longer exists. Russian mm-hmm. Empire no longer exists. Soviet Union no longer exists. Albania had a pretty strong state in the 15th century.
Putin's not ready to recognize the Soviet Union no longer exists.
Well, interesting point. Yeah, I don't know. I hope they wise up too.
Oh, this has been interesting, John.
Yeah, I've enjoyed this very much. I'm glad we decided to do it. I kept thinking, well, you know, we'll get around to it someday.
Yeah.
Not busy. What are you doing right now? Are you going off somewhere? I'm going to try to get hold of Lester. He's supposed to meet Ginger today,
and he's
leaving tonight.
I sent him a message just asking him if he needed any help getting his stuff to the airport, and he said, well, a friend was going to pick him up.
He's got a friend picking him up to do that, yeah. I told him I'd call him today. I just thought I might see what he's doing right now, because he's maybe running around at the last minute trying to
get everything organized.
Now. Yeah, and I, if I can help. Every time I look at this thing, I don't know what to do next.
I guess
reinventing the
wheel. If you've got something more to say, go ahead and say it. Otherwise, we'll close it out, I guess.
We could do it again sometime.
Yeah.
I can talk forever. I've just talked a lot of my friends that way.
Yeah. Okay, John. Well, thanks very much for your time.
Well, thanks very much for having the idea in the first place. It's not something I would have thought of by myself, but I'm glad you did.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that we did it, and you were right. And where the hell's Lester? Here, okay, here it is.
All right. John, thanks a lot.
What are you doing next? Are you going back to Spice of Heaven, that territory?
No particular plan. I'll be at Spice of Heaven tonight, but you got something in mind?
I'm going to talk to Lester.
Okay, you go talk to Lester and we'll see. So thank you very much, and we'll...
You're welcome.
Talk to you again.
When John and I get to talking, the time seems to fly by. We sort of lose track of time. Lots of interesting stuff here. First of all, what is anthropology? Here's how dictionary.com defines it. The science that deals with the origins, physical and cultural development, biological characteristics, and social customs and beliefs of mankind. So, I just usually say anthropology is the study of man. And under anthropology, we didn't get into this in this podcast, but archaeology is one area of anthropology. And it's interesting, you know, it's an area of interest for John, also an area of interest for me. My parents were missionaries, and sometimes there's a little bit of conflict between anthropologists and missionaries, which I'd like to talk about with John at some point. But missionaries do study anthropology. In fact, Billy Graham, when he went to Wheaton College, did not major in theology. He majored in anthropology. So, useful and fascinating study. I was particularly interested in what John had to say about Afghanistan, because I've had quite an interest in Afghanistan since my last... I had sort of a little sabbatical after I left Behung University. I was out for a year and a half, moved out to a village, and just did a lot of hiking up in the hills, and didn't send out resumes, didn't look for a job, and finally somebody called me, and they had arranged an interview for me. So I ended up at the China Youth University for 6 years, and that was that job was more fun than a barrel of monkeys. But anyway, during that interim period, I recall I was watching Al Jazeera, and I saw a video about the West Bank and, you know, how crowded it is. But you know, it's all the little children have their United Nations backpacks. And, they have
material needs supply. Then I see a video about Afghanistan. The kids are playing in the streets. Now, you know, it's not like they have no schools, but they're limited, and the training of the teachers is somewhat limited. And that got a lot better as the Americans were there. You know, people talk about us, what are we doing in Afghanistan? Well, the presence of the Americans allowed things to flourish that were not able to function before. And that's why leaving Afghanistan was such a tragedy. So anyway, that's where I really, as a teacher, became interested in Afghanistan. And lots of interesting things to say. Now, he mentions being in a tea house and listening to a ballad and about Joseph and Zuleika. And that confused me because Zuleika, that didn't ring a bell. You know, I didn't think that was the name of, what is it, Joseph married Pharaoh's daughter, right? The name just didn't ring a bell. So after talking to him, I Googled it, and it turns out Zuleika is the name from Jewish literature of Potiphar's wife. I'd never heard that before. It's not in the Bible, but it's in Jewish literature. So that's what that ballad was about. But a lot of stuff like that, you know, handed down from generation to generation. In the Pashtun culture, because there is at least the theory, and you know, quite seriously discussed about whether the Pashtun people are actually the lost 10 tribes of Israel. So then another thing we talked about was reading of the book and conversation with Elliot Undall, who had driven the Burma Road with a truckload of Bibles. And I misstated the history a little bit there. I said they used the Burma Road because the hump was so dangerous. Well, that was true in the end, but you know, the Burma Road existed before the hump. So the actual sequence is they had the Burma Road. Burma was overrun by the Japanese. Then they created this idea of flying over the hump, which basically means flying stuff from India over the Himalayas into China. But they lost a lot of planes, and it was very, very dangerous. So then they really pushed hard to get the Burma Road opened again, and were able to open it up again, and that's when people like Elliot Undall came through. So lots of interesting things to talk about. And I also mentioned Ashraf Ghani. I don't really know that much about Ashraf Ghani, but John has met him several times, and you know, I mentioned the comparison between Ashraf Ghani and Zelensky. And it's not really a fair comparison. I mean, if I had been Ashraf Ghani and the Taliban was taken over and Obama was president, I think I probably would have taken off too. There was just no chance that Ashraf Ghani could lead some sort of resistance against the Taliban. There are lots of reasons for that. And we have to admit a lot of it has to do with corruption within Afghanistan. And that's a big discussion that would take a whole podcast in itself and more. You know, Afghanistan, the graveyard of empires. You know, reading about how the British were devastated in 1842, I believe it was. Every country that's tried to occupy Afghanistan and somehow control it has, shall we say, met their match. So there's lots of interesting things there, and the future of it is hard to predict. I think it's tragic the Americans left. They could have kept 2,500 troops in there and allowed at least some measure of stability. I don't know what's going to happen with that. And then I was also curious about how John, you know, traveled around to many different places, and he gets to Kunming, and boom, he doesn't do any more traveling. He's been here for 20 years. And I think part of that is that there's just a lot of anthropology in Southeast Asia. Yunnan province is the area of China directly north of what used to be North Vietnam. Straight north of Vietnam is Yunnan province. It doesn't border on Thailand, but it's close to Thailand. It borders on Burma. Burma and Vietnam to the south, and then Burma to the west, Vietnam to the south, and then, of course, as you go toward China, Guangxi province, and Guizhou province, Sichuan to the north. So it's the part of Southeast Asia that's a little bit further north, but the reason it's a little bit more temperate here is not just because of the fact that it's further north, but also because of the altitude, the elevation. Because Shishuangbanna is not that far south of Kunming, but quite a bit warmer. Kunming is same elevation as Denver, same latitude as Honolulu. Okay, well, lots of good things to talk about, and I hope we get a chance in the future to talk more about belief and philosophy. You know, I always ask people, one of my favorite questions I ask people, what do you believe? About what? About anything. What do you believe? What we believe influences how we think, what we do, and so on. So we had a good discussion about that, but really only got started. I'd like to talk a lot more about that in the future. But a very good conversation, interesting conversation. So thanks for being with us, and we'll see you next time. This podcast is hosted online at beijingdiary.podbean.com. That's beijingdiary.podbean.com.